Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Dr. Gabor Maté, a physician, best-selling author, highly sought speaker on a range of topics from addiction and attention deficit disorder to mind-body wellness, adolescent mental health, and parenting. His most recent book is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. For the past 12 years, Dr. Maté has worked in Vancouver's notorious downtown Eastside neighborhood with patients suffering from hardcore drug addiction and mental illness and HIV. Today, we will not be taking your questions by phone or email, and Dr. Maté will join us in 5 minutes following a short news break on Line One, your health connection. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Gabor Maté. As I said before, he's a physician and a best-selling author. He's a speaker on a broad range of topics from addiction to attention deficit disorder and adolescent mental health and parenting. And a recent book he's written is called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, which describes some of his work and ideas about addiction that he developed from working in Vancouver's notorious downtown Eastside neighborhood with patients with hardcore drug addiction, mental illness, and HIV infections. Dr. Maté, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You know, I'd like to start this so people get a little better flavor of you. If you wouldn't mind, you've had an interesting career. You started as a teacher in history. If you could take us from that teaching episodes and what drove you back into medicine and finally to what you're doing now.
Well, interestingly enough, all my life I'd wanted to be a doctor, but what I found, unbeknownst to me, is that in late high school and my undergraduate university years, I didn't have the focus, I didn't have the discipline. I was one of these last-minute crammers, and I just didn't have the work ethic to pursue the scientific courses that the study of medicine demanded. I was diagnosed decades later in my 50s with attention deficit disorder, which all of a sudden made sense to me. And that became the subject of my first book, actually. But what happened was that I naturally drifted into subjects that I could study easily, that I could cram for at the last minute, and because of my relative facility with words, I could write good essays and so on, even if they were a bit short on content, they were good on style. So I could make it through English and history courses much more efficiently than I might have through heavy-duty science courses. So I did teach high school for a few years, and then the desire and the motivation to return to what really was my original passion became overwhelming, and I was much more motivated then, and I struggled through the science courses that got me into medical school, got the good enough marks. I was bright enough to do it, but because of my work habits and mind habits, it was a bit of a chore. But I did get into and through medical school, and then pursued a broad range of interests within the medical field.
Your books seem to address many different themes, and sometimes they're a little bit disparate from addiction and ADD, which I can already understand the ADD component to your interest, but parenting, and then I really appreciate your health and social policy interests. Is there some commonality there that brings all this back into focus?
Well, absolutely, and you've touched upon it. The commonality is that whether I look at cancer or rheumatoid arthritis or addiction or ADD or mental health conditions, it all comes back to what happens to people in childhood and how their brains and personalities are shaped, how their coping mechanisms develop, how their physiology is actually organized. And that has a lot to do with what happens in the family of origin, but it also has a lot to do with the social and economic and political context, because families are very much affected and shaped by what happens historically. And I work in British Columbia and you work in Alaska, and I'm not familiar with your work, but I imagine that a lot of it may have to do, for example, with what we call in Canada First Nations issues, you know, the Aboriginal population. Mm-hmm. And I know that both in Canada and in the U.S., this is a population that has been historically traumatized and for social and economic reasons continues to be. And we also see much more disease in this population. Mm-hmm. So simply you cannot separate people's life experience from the context in which that life is lived. and we can't separate that life experience then from the health outcomes of that life.
Mm-hmm. I like to think of that in the way I use the example, and you tell me if this is what you mean, but I use the example is that our brains are very good at learning. They're not very good at unlearning. And when I use that example to patients, I say, you know how to ride a bike. You learned how to ride a bike. Now tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike. And they understand that. And so what I hear you saying when I think like that is these early life experiences set down learning experiences that can be very difficult to unlearn.
Well, and you know, the analogy with the bike riding is actually a helpful one, because we learn how to ride a bike as a way to stay safe on that bike, you know.
Right, right.
Now, if I learn early in life that the way that I stay safe in a family of origin is that I don't express my emotions and I absorb everything and I remain self-repressed because my parents can't handle or would even be hostile to the expressions of my feelings, then I'll learn, in order to survive, to suppress my feelings. I wasn't born like that, but I'll develop that as a coping mechanism. Now, because that coping mechanism is associated with my very survival, it's almost as difficult as it is to unlearn riding a bike.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of effort, a lot of conscious effort.
Mm-hmm. So that gets back to this interest in parenting, obviously.
Yes, so that parenting and that the greatest prevention of illness is actually a happy and nourishing, emotionally nourishing family home. And I don't care what illness we look at, whether mental illness or physical illness. And, of course, under conditions of social stress, economic insecurity, that's very difficult for parents to provide to their kids very often. And especially with the breakdown of the traditional structures of clan and tribe and community, village, extended family, parents are more and more on their own, more and more stressed, less support, and children as a result are getting more and more diagnoses with all kinds of problems, ADHD, oppositionality, conduct disorders, autism, Asperger's, what have you, and we're medicating more and more kids, and all because the conditions for healthy development are less and less available.
So in that frame of reference then, and I know from listening to interviews, and you're not a believer that it's all just the psychosocial, that the genetics has a role to play, but that this social impact, this learning that goes on early, is perhaps in your frame of reference, the way you look at it, is a little bit more important even than that genetic frame. I don't want to overstate it.
I would put it more strongly than that, actually.
Okay.
Genes can predispose sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but they rarely cause. I mean, there's very few diseases
mm-hmm.
that you could name to me that are genetically determined.
Right.
I mean, how many can we think of between you and I as medical doctors? Well, there's Huntington's chorea, certain kinds of muscular dystrophy. If you have the gene, you're pretty much going to get the disease. But those diseases are very, very rare,
mm-hmm.
and it's not what we deal with. You know, the average physician will see one or two of them in a lifetime, you know,
mm-hmm.
unless they're specialists of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is that genes are turned on and off by the environment. So, and we know, for example, out of 100 women with breast cancer, only 7 will have the breast cancer genes. And out of 100 women with the genes, not all of them will get the cancer.
Right.
So while the genes can predispose, make it more likely that something will happen, they rarely determine. And we know now from the science of epigenetics that genes are turned on and off by the environment. So even if a child inherits a gene that might predispose to addiction in a healthy, nourishing environment, that gene never gets expressed. On the other hand, you can have children without those genes, and they abuse them, they have a higher risk of being addicted. So the environment, I think, for the most part, is far more important than genes are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just scientifically not even controversial.
I think that leads us back to this addiction, and particularly your most recent book. And I want to also bring in, when we talk about this, that you're going to be up here next week at the 30th Annual Alaska Health Summit, which is brought together by the Alaska Public Health Association. And you'll be talking on Tuesday the 15th. The title of your presentation is going to be The Hungry Ghost, again, a biopsychosocial perspective on addiction from heroin to workaholism. Tell us a little bit about what you'll be talking about. It sounds like we're moving in what you've talked about so far in that direction. Let's talk about addiction.
Sure. Well, for 12 years, I worked in, as you mentioned, in the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is known as North America's most concentrated area of drug use. And there we have thousands of drug users in a few square block radius, dependent on injectable substances such as heroin, crystal meth, cocaine, or other forms of delivery, but nevertheless heavily powerful drugs. And, you know, the rate of HIV and mental illness and hepatitis C and all kinds of other illnesses, of course, is very high in this population, as is the risk of early death. And I found in my practice, as I'll point out in my talk next week, is that everybody I dealt with in that population had been traumatized as children. And when I considered writing a book about it, I thought I'd just write a book about interesting work with troubled and very interesting people. I had not actually realized that literally no book had made the link between trauma and addiction and the development of the brain. Because we know now that the human brain develops in interaction with the environment. And when children are being traumatized, their brains don't develop some key essential circuits necessary for balanced living. And so that it's not just a question of the addictions, which is obvious, being desperate attempts to escape reality because reality is so horrible, but also that those traumas shape the brain in certain ways that make the development of addiction much more likely. And those pieces had literally not been put together by anybody in any publication that I read, which amazed me, because the research on the relationship between trauma and addiction is not controversial. It's widespread, and it's been published all over the place. And brain development, we know now for the last 20 years that the brain does develop under the impact of the environment, and we know what those conditions are that are necessary, and we know what the conditions are that are inimical for healthy development. And so I wrote my book, and there it is.
So, given that, what are we doing wrong in our treatment of addiction? And I guess I'd have to say the evidence that we're being successful is not good. So it raises the certain questions that perhaps you're right, and that we need to take a different approach. So, how are we doing it wrong? What would you do different?
Well, first of all, the assumption, the social assumption about addiction, and this is the assumption that buttresses the legal approach to addiction, is that it's a choice that somebody makes. And therefore, if somebody makes that choice, and we don't like the choice they're making, how do we deal with it? We deter them. How do we deter them? By draconian punishments. So that we live in a social context that punishes the addict. In my view, we're punishing them for having been abused. And secondly, we're doing that rather arbitrarily, because it's perfectly all right for people to kill themselves with cigarettes. But a drug like heroin, which actually, unless you overdose on it, it's much less dangerous to your health than cigarettes are, is illegal, and you go to jail if you possess it. So that, first of all, we create a social context in which the very habit is illegal, and you're outside the law if you're engaged in it, which creates a lot of stress for people. Now, stress is the greatest trigger when it comes to addictions. The more stressed you are, the more likely you are to relapse. That's just clear. And so what I'm saying is that never mind what we're doing wrong in the medical system, which I can get to, but in terms of the whole social apparatus and social approach to addictions, we've taken exactly the wrong attitude. And our jails are full of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who is the world's arguably the world's greatest trauma expert in the medical field anyway. He's a professor of psychiatry in Boston. And he says that 100% of the inmates of the federal justice system in the States, or the criminal justice in the States, are actually abused children. So now if we want to help somebody who's been abused, do we help them by punishing them more, by making them illegal, by impoverishing them, by ostracizing them? So that in that social context, it's very difficult to help people, even if the medical system got it right. But the second, but secondly, the medical system doesn't get it right. I don't know how many lectures you heard about trauma in medical school. I didn't hear any. And they still don't talk about trauma in most medical schools. So the relationship between early childhood experience and later on outcomes, outcomes which include not only addiction, but also mental health conditions and physical conditions like cancer and rheumatoid disease and all that, they're never mentioned to medical students. So physicians are completely incapable of seeing what's in front of them, which is that they're dealing with a traumatized population. So we focus something only on trying to change the behavior. And then from the medical perspective, our assumption is that the behavior simply reflects the disease of the brain, which is probably genetic. So we're not looking at people's lives. We're not looking at their experiences. We're not looking at the emotional stressors. So not recognizing, not even thinking of the causes of things, how are we going to help people? And then we do our best to change their behaviors, but of course we can't because we don't understand the behaviors. And secondly, we basically end up trying to medicate them. So if you're on heroin, we're going to give you methadone. Well, that's fine. That may be a step forward. At least you're not injecting every day. But you're still left addicted. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, our approach just does not take into account the human realities that drive addiction. How could it possibly succeed? And so no wonder we have such a huge failure rate.
You know, what you say rings a bell of similarity to me. We've, on the program, been addressing healthcare costs in the United States over the last several years. And as we're struggling, and actually everybody is, but particularly in the United States, where we spend twice as much as everybody else and yet have decreasing, decreasing evidence or decreasing markers for benefit, and how that appears to be, at least in the last 25 or 30 years, related to socioeconomic diversity, that we've spread out the highest and the lowest income providers, and that not only have we worsened our health indicators during that period of time, other countries who have narrower ones have improved theirs. And so this gets back to the social milieu, the psychosocial milieu, in a way that it seems that you're discussing.
Well, you know, all kinds of studies have shown that the brains of kids in poverty don't develop the way they should, you know, so that the greater the gap, we also know that the more stressed parents are. For example, I mean, studies have shown clearly now that the more stressed are the parents, the greater risk of asthma in the child. Asthma, mm-hmm. You know. Now, of course, pollution increases asthma, that's obvious. But in polluted areas, it's those parents whose children are most, those children whose parents are more stressed are the ones most likely to have asthma. Because the parental stress is actually have a great impact on the hormonal responses of children to stress. Mm-hmm. And then we end up treating asthma with stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol or their analogs. But we never ask ourselves, does stress have anything to do with it? Now, the more you stress people economically, socially, and you do it in the context of increased isolation, because communities are breaking down, the more disease you're going to get. It's just obvious.
Mm-hmm. Back to your idea about the psychosocial origins of addiction. My mind goes to thinking, well, what about countries where there's a greater emphasis on those early childhood development years? Especially with teachers, but also with parenting. And I immediately think, at least my gestalt is, the Scandinavian countries are very good at trying to promote those early childhood development years by encouraging time off, parents to be home with kids, and so forth. If your thoughts are right, if your theory is right, that there's a lot of origin, then the addictive issues should be less of an issue in that country. Does that make sense, and is that what has been found?
Well, it makes sense, although, of course, at the same time as in the Scandinavian countries, they do offer generous support for parents to stay home, including to fathers even.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the United States, even mothers don't get maternity leave. I mean, only 6 weeks, I think, is the average maternity leave in the U.S.
Right.
Whereas the infants need to be with their parents for at least a year, I would say, you know, minimally, hopefully longer. But I don't know what their statistics are.
Okay.
I can't tell you. And of course, you know, it's not that there's no stress in those societies either.
Right, right. Or that we have great parenting just because you're with your parents. I mean, it doesn't necessarily follow.
Yeah, but I can't tell you their statistics. Okay. I know that I received an email from Norway recently. Somebody there was reading the book, and they said, has it been translated? Because we need it desperately over here. So, so there you go. That's a single email. I don't know what to make of it.
Is there a different psychosocial view of addiction in Canada than there is in the United States?
No, I would say that the Canadian, there are some differences in practice, you know, and certainly in British Columbia, it's much easier for a physician like myself to put somebody on methadone than it is for somebody in the States. Generally, that's my understanding. I can do that within a day, and nobody's going to ask too many questions, although I'm being monitored, but I'm not being intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the overall approach in understanding addiction, I don't think there's a huge difference. I mean, mostly Canadians read American textbooks, and Canadian addiction physicians go through the American Academy of Addiction Medicine to get their certification, and so really it's the same flow of information that informs both groups.
Dr. Mate, we typically take a short break in the middle of our program. I'm going to take it right now. It's about 1 minute. So I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. We'll join our guest, Dr. Gabor Mate, and we'll be continuing his discussion on his views on addiction and some other topics in just a minute. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is joining us by telephone from Vancouver, British Columbia. It's Dr. Gabor Mate. He's a physician and author. We've been talking about his particular interest most recently in hardcore drug addiction. He's recently written a book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, which describes some of his thoughts about addiction, which came from the last several years of working in Vancouver's downtown East Side neighborhood with patients suffering from hardcore drug addiction and mental illness and HIV infections.
I'd like to jump in if I could.
Sure.
Just to come back to our previous conversation about genes, I just was fiddling on the computer here, and I store studies on my computer, and here's a particular study that shows they look at infants of a few months of age, and they looked particularly the response of the vagus nerve. The vagus is a nerve is an important nerve that runs from the brain stem to many of the organs in the body, particularly in the chest, heart cavity, and the intestine, and the abdominal cavity. And the vagal tone, the particular activity of the vagus nerve, can slow up or speed up the heart. And during stress, the vagus nerve should decrease its effect on the heart to allow the heart to speed up and the body to respond to stress. In some babies, this decrease in the tone of the vagus nerve doesn't happen because these kids have a specific gene mutation in the so-called DRD2 gene, okay? So that kids with this gene will not respond to stress as effectively. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, but what they've shown, And this gene has to do with the transmitter dopamine, which is, of course, heavily addicted in addiction, implicated in addictions as well. The long and short of it is that children who receive sensitive parenting from early on. By 12 months of age, their stress response is just as effective, even if they don't, even if they have this abnormal gene, than those of the kids who have the normal gene. In other words, the effective parenting, the sensitive, attuned parenting, overrides the effects of the gene. That's the take-home message here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was attempting to say about genes.
Sure. Okay.
This study was published, the report of it was published in the Scientific American a couple of years ago.
Does this idea of the psychosocial origins of hardcore drug addiction extend to alcohol or maybe even other addictive behaviors?
Well, first of all, I think that there's no separate addictions. What there is a universal addiction process. Mm-hmm. So the brain circuits implicated in addictions mm-hmm. are the same, whether or not you're addicted to sex or to cocaine, mm-hmm. whether to alcohol or to heroin or to work.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the reward and motivation circuits of the brain and the impulse regulation circuits of the brain and the stress regulation circuits of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that and also the emotional pain. The emotional distress that addictions are all desperate attempts to escape from is the same, whether it's a gambling addiction or whether it's a heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, and actually what you find is that many people who have one addiction will have other addictions. Because there's you find that if people quit one, they'll go to another. Like what happens to people that quit smoking? They typically start overeating because they're still trying to soothe themselves. Except that they found a different way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's this universal addiction process that involves all addictive behaviors. And it all does go back to childhood experience. Now, the greater the trauma, the greater the risk of addiction, and the more likely the severe addiction. But what I'm saying is that these are not discrete. These addictions are not discrete. Separate entities. It's
right.
Not that internet addiction here and cocaine addiction there. It's that they're in a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us as human beings in this very troubled culture are on that continuum at one point or another. At least I don't know about
mm-hmm.
you, but I know about
mm-hmm.
me.
Right.
I know that I'm on that continuum.
Right.
I may not have a substance addiction, and I never had a substance addiction, but I've had behavior addictions.
Right.
And I think most people are. And it's a question of how much luck you've had in life, really.
Right. So following in your thought and getting back to my trying to be simplistic here about thinking about we've got this hardwiring that teaches us how to ride a bike. We can't unlearn it, so we have to work around it if we want to do something different. And so as I understand the psychosocial developmental aspects that you're discussing, we've got this reward system that's set up in a certain way due to some lack of more appropriate loving and response reward system early in childhood. And so if
right.
we're going to treat addiction now, we have got to work around those built-in hardwired reward systems by caring, by changing our psychosocial aspect, how we look at addiction and trying to help people get more reward and more, I guess, a loving way. I don't know if that's the right way to think about it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, Dr. Bruce Perry, who's a child psychiatrist and an author himself, and he's the head of the Houston Child Trauma Academy, he said in those words to me when I interviewed him, he said, these people need to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Yak Panksepp, who's a great, great researcher in neurophysiology and his relationship to the environment, he's written a wonderful book called Affective Neurophysiology. He works in Washington State right now. And he said that what the addicts need is what he calls an island of relief, relief from the really the social attack that they're under all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what the problem is, that even if the medical profession got it, which it doesn't,
mm-hmm.
but even if it did, we'd still be working in a context that's very much conditioned by hostility towards drug addicts. And this utterly insane and, to say the least, counterproductive, damaging, unjustifiable, and utter failure of which you call the war on drugs. And in that context, you know, if you look at a country like Portugal, which has now decriminalized the possession of drugs, so you can actually own a couple of days' supply of heroin, and you will not be jailed. not increased. In fact, they've gone down a bit, and a lot more people are in treatment. And a lot fewer people are in jail, of course. Well, that's the beginning of a sane approach. Mm-hmm. But here in North America, we're far away from that.
How are you doing this in the downtown east side of Vancouver? What's your approach?
Well, just to clarify, I no longer work there. Having worked there for 12 years, I'm just too busy traveling and speaking now and teaching to do the clinical work. But in any case, the work that I was involved with, and which continues, in the downtown city of Vancouver, may broadly be characterized as harm reduction, which means that you take the harm of the addiction and you try and reduce it, and you take the harm of the toxic social attitudes towards the addict, and you try and reduce that too. And so to give you one example, we have North America's only, shameful to say, only, shameful for the rest of North America, supervised injection site. People can bring their drugs here without fear of arrest and inject, be given clean needles, be given sterile water, be given an alcohol swab to cleanse their arms, a tourniquet, and if necessary, even help to find a vein. Mm-hmm. And they do so under nursing supervision, and if they overdose, they're resuscitated. Mm-hmm. Now, the result is less transmission of HIV, which is, of course, results in great savings to the healthcare system, less transmission of hepatitis C, less number of abscesses, infections, and so on, and the saving of lives after potentially fatal overdoses. And it's also the introduction of some of these people for the first time to healthcare professionals that actually accept them for who they are, mm-hmm. which can then be the first step towards their recovery.
Right.
So that's an approach that we've been able to establish here in Vancouver in the teeth of opposition from our current federal government who tried to shut the place down. Mm-hmm. And the case was fought all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, which court ruled 9-0 against the government on this one. Mm-hmm. So we were able to keep the site open. But that's an example of what we do here. But again, that's just a small drop in the bucket, because it would take much more in terms of treatment, rehab, and so on to really help people, because, again, the addicted brain wasn't right to start with and then is further damaged by the drug use. It's going to take a long time for that brain to become normal again.
Mm-hmm.
These people would need a lot of support, counseling, mm-hmm. skills training, patience, healthy nutrition, contact with nature, whole new ways of relating to people. And who's got the money when all the money is being spent on jailing people? Mm-hmm. Billions are being spent on building new jails in my country.
So we get back to prevention.
Well, we get back to prevention, or we get back to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But we also get back to, it's not that we don't have the resources, it's that we spend the resources on punishing people.
Right, okay.
Instead of helping them.
Right.
What if all those billions, the federal government in Canada,
mm-hmm.
spending billions, literally billions, and establishing or strengthening jail facilities because they've toughened up the drug laws in the teeth of all the evidence, in the face of all the evidence, what if they spend those billions on treatment, rehab, and prevention? Can you imagine what would happen? So it's not that we don't know what to do, or at least it's not that the knowledge of what to do is not available to us. It's simply that, owing to social prejudice and utter ignorance, willful ignorance, by the way, we're doing what needs to be done.
Yeah, it reminds me also we've discussed cognitive dissonance. Some of the other things that are coming out of cognitive psychology and social psychology is how we're understanding how our brain works, and we will go out of our way to not change our mind, even given the facts, which gets to this social prejudice and injustice, which, I mean, I certainly can see it. It is, but I can also see why it is so difficult to get people to change their attitudes. I mean, what more perfect example of not only how we look at addiction and how we treat it, but just our political system, particularly in the United States, is how we can't. It's freezing up our whole system because we can't see each other's point of view or be willing to negotiate So I find what we're learning about how our brains work in other ways is fascinating to help us understand.
But, you know, and it's interesting because when you look at, I recently looked at some of the literature around political views and brains.
Right.
And it turns out, I don't know if you're aware of this, but it turns out that people who tend to have more authoritarian right-wing points of view, their amygdala, which is the fear center, is larger. And parts of the brain that regulate insight in the prefrontal cortex are smaller. And knowing what I know about brain development, that childhood trauma increases the size of the amygdala. Mm-hmm. I think there's a real relationship between even people's political views and their childhood experience.
Interesting.
You know, and I don't want to make that absolute, and I don't want to make it the
right
factor. But I think it all comes back to that, which means that people's political perspectives don't so much come from a rational place where you could actually have discussion and exchange of views, but it comes more from an emotional position. So if you look at, for example, people who deny climate change, who absolutely deny it, who are hostile to it, you'd think that the more educated people would be less that way. But actually, if you're a climate change denier, the more educated you are, the more likely you are to be entrenched in your opinions. Because all you're doing is using your education to justify your emotional position. You're in a stance of denial about reality, and the more education you've got, the more you use your smarts to protect that denial.
Mm-hmm. Remind
all this, to go back to our conversation, makes it much more difficult then to change
people's
point of view about addiction. But especially since, you see, most people have some, you know, if you define addiction as I do, which is any behavior that is associated with craving, temporary relief, but negative long-term consequences, and you persist in it despite those negative consequences, then who in our culture does not have some addictions? And that's my definition of addiction. It may or may not have to do with substances. You know, any behavior that has negative consequences that gives you relief in the short term, but trouble in the long term, but you don't give it up, is an addiction. Now, given that so many of us are affected by it, it's easy then to isolate the drug addict and to make him the scapegoat and to see him as sort of the really troubled outsider, where we're superior to that. And we do that in order to make ourselves feel better because we know on some level that we are just like them. And we don't want to acknowledge that.
Let me take one second, Dr. Mate, to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I took the liberty today that I've decided not to take phone calls and emails for questions. I wanted to do a straight interview. If you want to get more information about Dr. Mate, if you go to Line 1 at alaskapublic.org, we have some links to his website and a couple of his interviews, one a very long interview about brain development and addiction. So there's lots of ways to get more information about Dr. Mate and his ideas about what we're talking about today.
I hope that some listeners, if they're so motivated, may want to check out my books as well.
Sure.
I've written books on ADD, on addiction, on stress and health, and also on parenting, so that anybody who's interested and finds this perspective interesting can certainly.
And they can get to that link from your website online or on alaskapublic.org. So we'd like to promote that. Another thing on your website, which I think kind of fits what we've been discussing, there's a quote from A.H. Almas, which says, quote, "Only when compassion is present will people allow themselves to see the truth." Put that into perspective with what we've been talking about.
Well, we think generally that the way to deal with what we consider to be bad behaviors is to be controlling and critical and punitive. So we do that with kids. And, of course, we do it with drug addicts. And yet, you know, the larger purpose is not to change a behavior. The larger purpose is to teach somebody something, to help them see the truth about themselves, to help a child recognize why it's better to behave one way than another way, you know, what's right about it, to have an addict fully come to terms with the negative impact of his or her addiction. And with Almas, the spiritual teacher from California, saying that if you want people to see the truth, you have to take a compassionate, non-judgmental attitude towards them. And that's, of course, not that I 100% agree with the 12-step groups, but what they do provide is a non-judgmental atmosphere where people can actually face the truth. You know, when you're not being judged, then you can admit without fear of shame that, yes, I have an addiction problem. Mm-hmm. And this addiction problem is destroying me and my life and the lives of those people close to me. Well, when you attack people, criticize them, they're much more likely to be in a mode of defending themselves. And when you're defending yourself, you can't generate insight. So what Amos says is 100% true, that only when compassion is present will people then have the sense of security to look honestly at themselves. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't know what it's like in your work, but even saying what I'm saying and knowing what I know, I can sometimes be very judgmental towards people, and I can generate a certain attitude, which makes people very defended around me, and they're not going to be inclined to really investigate themselves that clearly. So I really have to watch it with myself, you know, when I'm talking about working days, when on a given day, if I'm more critical and more stressed and less present emotionally than other days, on those days, my interactions didn't go that well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's about them, and actually it's about me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I hate to admit it as a physician, but you know, part of burnout is losing that compassion. The reason you went into to this profession to help people, and I get mad at myself when I feel like I'm losing that compassion, and inevitably I need to step back and get some relax. It's me, it's not them.
Yeah, and you need to ask yourself, you know, well, what triggered me, and in what way didn't I look after myself, you know, all that, you know. But again, you know, we know when we are compassionate and we know when we're not. Now, we know it if we're aware of that dynamic, unfortunately. In medical training, at least the one that I received, there's not a whole lot of stuff about being compassionate to oneself or even compassionate to anybody else. It's more about the techniques and the technologies and the physiology of things.
When I think about what you're saying, and I think about, unfortunately, maybe movies or books that I read, that often people who have grounded themselves in deeply into poor addiction kind of issues, there's a spiritual answer that seems to rescue them. Again, that may be overdone. It's just the literature. It's just the movies. But I can see from your description that if a person were to have some deep spirituality, it gives them some feeling of worth, some feeling of someone cares about them, which is a little bit about, a lot like what you're having to say. You want to comment on spirituality?
Well, yeah, spirituality to me means that you're recognizing yourself, experiencing yourself, seeking yourself, something more than just an isolated, egoic, selfish individual, but that you're part of something greater, be it nature, be it creation, however you conceptualize that. And in other words, that there's a higher power, which isn't necessarily a guy in the sky with a beard and a thunderbolt, but it certainly is a sense of larger unity. And the French writer, philosopher Blaise Pascal said that inside every human being there's a God-shaped hole. In other words, there's a kind of an emptiness there if we're not connected to the larger. I think that addiction specifically, very often, we ignore the spiritual dimension, which is that need of connection and belonging and something larger than we are. So the people that pursue that, they do find some support, significant support in that, in dealing with their human problems, be it addiction or anything else. Now, for some people, that may happen in a religious context. For others, it may not. But the issue is not religion or the lack of it. The issue is spirituality or the lack of it. And you can have religion without spirituality, of course.
Where are the debates coming from in your approach? What's the tradition? How we're locked into how we approach it? Where are there arguments against being more compassionate and spending our money in a more compassionate way?
Well, I believe it's mostly the ignorance of the causes. Mm-hmm. In other words, the despite the brain science that in itself is not controversial, most physicians are not aware of how the brain is actually shaped by the environment. They just don't. They don't know these facts. They have not access. They have access, but no knowledge of this information. And then again, we live in North America, where the ethic is very much that of individualism, and we actually believe that people are individualistic, selfish, hostile, and aggressive creatures. This is what we think is human nature, which is the very opposite. But in a capitalist system, which is dedicated to the aggrandizing of profit and the power of some people, as you've mentioned, over the increasingly deprived many, you're going to get ideologies, including medical ideologies, that support that point of view. So the separation of mind and body and the separation of the individual from the environment very much goes along with the North American ethic. Mm-hmm. So that the medicine that we practice reflects not only science, which it does to some blessedly significant degree, but it also reflects an ideological context, and that no longer has to do with science. It has to do with social and economic reality. Not to mention, of course, that the research that you and I read in the medical journals is for the most part funded by pharmaceutical companies. That doesn't make the research wrong, but it makes it very skewed. Mm-hmm. There's no profits to be made out of promoting healthy attachments for young kids. Who's going to make a buck on that?
Right.
But you're all going to make lots of bucks on giving kids who are deprived that way medications to control their behaviors. And then, of course, that's what we read. That's what we are, mm-hmm. are then encouraged to employ in our practice.
Since I deal almost daily with kids with attentional issues and behavioral issues, as you've mentioned, would you help me understand how your biopsychosocial view of those particular problems? I think I can understand the emotional thing. I'm a little struggling with the attention deficit issue there.
Oh, really? Okay. Thanks for that question. it's like you just sent me a softball that I can hit it out of the park. tuning out, the absent-mindedness, which is the hallmark of ADD, is not a disease. What is it actually? Are you able to say?
Well, I look at it as impulsivity and insatiability.
Well, that's a part of it, but right now I'm talking about the tuning out part. Hmm. Why do people have the capacity to tune out?
Why do they get distracted? And over? I don't know. I guess
No. It's very simple. It's a stress response mechanism. Hmm.
Well, certainly under stress, we don't think as clearly, and we don't process.
But not only that. If you're severely stressed, mm-hmm. and you can't escape, you can't fight back, it's beyond your capacity to deal with the situation. Mm-hmm. You can't ask for help. One of the ways that brains will protect you from the overwhelming stress is to tune it out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tuning out is not a disease. It's a defense mechanism.
Gotcha.
Now, that's the first point. Mm-hmm. The second point is that the brain develops under the impact of the environment, as I've already mentioned.
Right.
Now, when kids, by the end of the third year of life, the human brain is 90% adult size, and most of these circuits develop between birth and the first few years of life. Now, when there's a lot of stress in the environment, because the parents are stressed, like in my case, because I was a Jewish infant under Nazi occupation in Hungary, with the mother who was traumatized by the death of her parents and the absence of her father and of her husband in a forced labor camp. I was a very stressed little infant. I couldn't fight back, escape, or seek help. How do I deal with it? By tuning it out. But when was I tuning it out? When my brain was developing. The tuning out becomes programmed into my brain. Hmm. It's an automatic default setting. 50 years later, I'm diagnosed with ADD. Mm-hmm. Not only that, biologically speaking, when we give Ritalin or Dexedrine to a child for ADD, what are we trying to do? We're trying to elevate the levels of dopamine in the brain. Dopamine is the incentive motivation chemical. The dopamine circuits don't develop under conditions of stress. Mm-hmm. You can stress animals, it'll reduce their dopamine receptors. Mm-hmm. So the more stressed the environment is that children grow up in, the more likely they are to A, lack dopamine, and B, resort to tuning out as a stress response. Mm-hmm. Not only that, the impulse regulation circuits of the brain in the orbitofrontal cortex also need an attuned, emotionally present parenting environment. So the less that is available, the rest, the impulse control develops. And by the way, if you look at brain scans of drug addicts, impulse regulation circuitry, the right orbitofrontal cortex, is the most likely to be disturbed. So that the more stress that the infants experience, or young children, in the parenting environment, not because the parents don't love them, mm-hmm. but because the parents themselves are dealing with more stress than they know what to do with, the more likely those kids are then to resort to tuning out, and the more less likely it is that their dopamine and impulse regulation circuits will develop properly. And that's why we're seeing so many more kids diagnosed with ADHD. And you show me any family with an ADHD child, and I can tell you that that family experienced a lot of stress when that kid was small. So the physiology and the tuning out are all connected to that early stress, which also means that we're not dealing here with a disease. What we're dealing with is a developmental problem. Now, if we're dealing with a developmental problem, then the question is not how do you control the symptoms. At least that's not the only question. An equally important and, I think, more important question is how do we help this child develop? Knowing that the human brain retains the capacity for plasticity even later on in life, and certainly later on in childhood, the question really ought to be is not how do you control these kids' symptoms, but how do you give them the right conditions so their brains can correct themselves as much as possible. Well, all that is discussed in my book, which is entitled Scattered in the United States, Scattered, How ADHD Develops and What You Can Do About It.
I wish we had more time to do that. We are coming right close to the end here, Dr. Mate, and you're right. You hit the ball right over my head deep into center field, and I would love to spend more time on it. I wanted to definitely hit the addiction. I didn't understand how much I need to understand your approach to attention deficit disorder, so... Perhaps.
Well, gee, I hope I hit it beyond center field. I hope
it's well over my head, but I definitely want to come back if we get the opportunity. I'd love to talk some more, particularly about that aspect. I like the psychosocial stuff.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks very much. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. Bye.
So my guest today was Dr. Gabor Mate. I apologize again for taking the time to just do a straight interview and not accept calls and questions. If you have more you want to talk about, you can continue the conversation on KSKA on Facebook, as you may know if you listen to the program regularly. And you can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. At that place, you can also find links to Dr. Gabor's website and some of his other interesting interviews. Next week is going to be another, I think, very, very good program. If any of you have never had back pain, you can avoid the program. But if you had, you're going to want to listen, because our next guest will be one of the world's authorities on back pain, Dr. Stuart McGill. He's professor of spine biomechanics at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. Many of our listeners should pick up some tips on back pain from this program, so why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, January 14th from 2 to 3 p.m. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.